the Age of Vision radio show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. From 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, here on UCY.TV radio, we relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision radio show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear. Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Fission radio show. Thank you for joining us, and I want to thank our affiliate, KEPW, in Eugene, Oregon, for carrying our show. Today, I'm pretty excited. We're doing a pre-recorded interview. It's December 23rd, 2017, with Dr. Circus, Mark Circus, who Jerome interviewed a few weeks ago. I was super excited to hear the interview. And I spoke with him yesterday, and he offered to do the interview today, so here we are. Thank you, Dr. Circus, for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, as my listeners know, I actually am pretty much anti-AMA, and I was really excited. The thing that really made me want to talk to you was when you said on air that we no longer have low levels of radiation around the planet since the bombing. You were the first person I've ever heard say that, actually. You've been doing this a long time. One of my questions I wanted to ask you is, why do you think that people are so resistant, like I was, to even open their minds to this? What creates that?
Pure propaganda, pure conditioning, like Pavlov's dog. You know, most people have been totally conditioned through many years, through many means, the TV, radio, newspapers, to believe in certain things. And it works. It just works. The Nazis weren't the first ones. This is old communication technology. But basically, the most powerful men in the world and the most aggressive understand that you can enslave people by getting control of their imaginations. And what you suggest to them through years of constant propaganda, what people start to see, they believe. It doesn't matter how big of a lie it is. It doesn't matter how dangerous nuclear radiation is. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You can treat a cancer person with lethal levels of radiation, which is basically what they do.
Yeah.
10 treatments of radiation, that's lethal levels.
Right.
It took a long time for me to track down, you know, on the internet what those levels were. And I finally found two sites, and it's lethal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's okay. I mean, it's just normal. You can expose women to mammograms every year, every 2 years. Every single mammogram increases the chance of getting cancer. That's fine. It doesn't matter if scientists and doctors around the world saying, no, it's not fine. you can say it's not fine, but the mainstream accepted fact is it's fine. So
well, it's
a kind of a crazy world we live in.
How is it that the world, like the scientists around the world, never mention radioactivity as a cause of death of the mass animal deaths? Do you understand? Like, you've been, how can you share with our listeners how long you've been doing this industry? Like, how long of a journey has this been for you?
Oh, since 1985 or so, maybe a little before.
Wow. So it's been a long time.
35 years.
Are you in Brazil because you can't participate, you can't function here
yep.
in America?
I mean, actually, for 2 weeks in Rio de Janeiro, the beautiful city. But I live in the interior, in the central highlands. I built a sanctuary, like a place really at the end of the world. The house is surrounded on three sides by two rivers.
Wow.
So it's a paradise. I built the kingdom of heaven on earth, which has been my destiny since forever.
Wow. Well, congratulations. That's really magnificent. Makes me want to. I have a friend of mine who's Brazilian. She keeps talking about me going back home with her. Maybe I will take her up on that. But the reason that you're in Brazil is because of the AMA, who I call the American Murder Association.
Indirectly. I mean, directly I'm here because of God. You know, I prayed for a new life 26 years ago, and 5 hours later I got my answer. For sure, if I would have stayed, I could not have done the work I've done without getting myself killed in the United States. So, you know, I've been down here 26 years. I haven't been back to the States in 22 years. And that's the way it's going to stay for the rest of this lifetime. And I love Brazil. I have 6 Brazilian kids.
Wow, that's awesome.
More Brazilian than American at this point.
Yeah, I should think so. I should think you are. What do you tell somebody who says, how do you not eat fish? You're in Brazil with, you know, do you eat fish?
Yes, I do.
But you're eating and Brazilian fish.
One of the main reasons to not eat fish, well, from the northern Pacific, of course, you got all the increased radiation from Fukushima. It's already polluted the North Pacific. But the you talk about radiation, it's not really fair to isolate it. You know, there's radiation happening, and it's been, since they started the nuclear age, it's just been increasing. And since doctors, you know, worse than the barbers who used to, you know, just bleed you to cure you, you know, these doctors just got into this incredibly terroristic frame of mind to start using nuclear radiation to diagnose people and to treat people. So between... Actually, exposure is highest from the doctors and hospitals than it is from the environment.
Wow.
But mercury, for instance.
Right.
Mercury, heavy metals, not radioactive, but we have been putting out megatonnage every day since the beginning of the coal age. You know, when you burn coal, the problem with burning coal is not so much the CO2. That's not a problem at all, actually. And you can turn that CO2 into bicarbonate if they just wanted to do something, you know, fancy. But the main problem with coal and living anywhere near a coal plant, electrical, is the mercury it's pouring out into the air. I mean, I guess the United States is 20 tons of mercury a year. I mean, all over the world, it's like 3,000, 4,000 tons. And one drop will pollute a lake.
Wow.
So mercury is a big problem. Before that, and still is, lead. Of course, we used to have lead gasoline. But there's been a lot of lead into the environment. So we have lots of heavy metals. And then you're blasting people with kids with vaccines, has lots of mercury. Well, some of them have mercury, but lots of aluminum and a lot of other garbage. And, of course, the pesticides and the herbicides and the fungal side. We're just surrounded by poison. And it's not just the radiation, though. Radiation is, again, it's a big problem, especially if you believe in doctors. And doctors believe in hurting you. So, you know, the first thing to do is stop hurting people.
Exactly. But that's, just stop.
But that's too much for human beings. You know, we've been like a vampire race forever. We've been very nasty to children forever. You know, we just, you know, like being nasty, and doctors have just, you know.
Money. It's all about money, isn't it, doctor?
Money, power.
Yeah, they look at us.
Greed.
They really do look at us. I say this in my intro. They look at us as assets on a balance sheet, don't they? Like, we really are just part of it all. Well, one of the things I want to ask you is, I was looking at your website, and you were talking about bicarbonate soda, which was really interesting. That's a basic thing you were saying, you know, some simple things that people can do. How does that work, just taking, you know, bicarbonate soda, baking soda, without aluminum, you know?
Yeah, then none of them have aluminum. That's just a marketing thing.
Oh.
It's a baking powder. Has aluminum in it, but baking soda, sodium bicarbonate, doesn't. Well, before I answer that question, let me put it in context, a new context, which will change the way medicine will be practiced and conceived, not for the next 1,000 years, but the next forever. It's a new book I'm writing, and it's called Hydrogen Medicine. So I'm going to talk about hydrogen gas, and hydrogen gas in, dissolved in water. And the subtitle of the book is Combining Oxygen with Hydrogen and CO2, carbon dioxide. So I'm going to back into what I was just said with the carbon dioxide.
Okay.
Which is the answer to your question. It's one of the three primary gases, oxygen, hydrogen, and carbon dioxide. When we exercise, one of the reasons exercise is so wonderful is because we create a lot of carbon dioxide. It's a very healthy gas. The more carbon dioxide we have or generate, the healthier we are. It's just why? Because the more carbon dioxide you have or retain in your blood, the more oxygen your cells get. Because carbon dioxide and oxygen are very related gases, very related. We breathe because of, not because we need more oxygen, it's because we need to get rid of some carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide stimulates the breath. So, what?
That's interesting.
Sodium bicarbonate, baking soda, what is it? When you drink it and it hits the stomach acid. The same thing happens if you put squeeze a lemon into a glass of sodium bicarbonate. Same thing, in the stomach or in the glass, the acids turn bicarbonate into CO2. So if you're watching the glass, you'll see the bubbles. Or if you drink sodium bicarbonate just with water, if it's really working, you're going to belch, because the acid, if you have good stomach acid, it's going to interact with the bicarbonate and turn it into CO2, and then you belch. But that CO2 gets driven into the blood, directly into the blood, in the form of CO2 in the form of bicarbonate. And in the blood, bicarbonate and CO2 are the same thing. They change into each other at the speed of light. They're like sisters. They're two forms of the same thing. Okay, just now one big thing. Normally, as I say, we breathe to get rid of CO2. We breathe faster when we're exercising, obviously. But what happens when you're sitting on your butt in front of a computer or TV all day and you don't exercise and you're breathing fast? You should be breathing fast because there's a lot of CO2. But in this case, you're just breathing fast for whatever many reasons. What's happening is you're getting rid of CO2.
Oh, okay.
You're not exercising. You're not making more, but you're breathing instead of 10 or 12 breaths a minute, you're breathing at 20 or 22, double. That's how you get cancer, because you're driving down the CO2. You're getting rid of the CO2 that you don't even have. You're not making a lot. And when you get rid of the CO2, what happens? The blood pressure goes up because the blood vessels contract. And the oxygen disassociation curve, it's called, oxygen jumping on or off red blood cells, is diminished. So CO2 is very important. Hmm. So there's two ways of increasing CO2. There's actually more, but two basic ways. One is use the cheapest medicine in the world, which is sodium bicarbonate, baking soda. You can buy it by the pound for very little. And you load up, you can instantly increase CO2, which instantly dilates the blood vessels, which instantly changes the oxidative curve. And so instantly, basically, you get more oxygen. Okay, so that's the whole sodium bicarbonate, baking soda, breathing slowly.
You're talking just regular baking soda that you buy in the store, the Arm & Hammer baking soda.
Yeah, regular baking soda.
Wow. Now, if a person was to start taking that, do you take it, like, how much do you take and how often and when?
Depends what you're using it for. If you want to treat your cancer with it, again, because you want, in cancer or any medical treatment, you want to increase hydrogen, oxygen, and CO2. So here we're talking about just CO2. And so if you wanted to treat your cancer, you take enough bicarbonate to get your urinary pH up to 8. If you're not dying of cancer, but you want to use it, you could talk about 3 half teaspoons a day. 3 or 4 quarter teaspoons.
Throughout.
It depends.
The day. Just spread it out. So a normal person, like, as part of your, do you take it as a normal part of your daily nutritional routine?
When I'm being good to myself, yes.
Huh. Wow. Okay. Well, I think I'm going to add that in.
And, you know, I use this, it's a device called the Fravrov breathing device. It comes from Russia. It was sold for a while as called the Breath Slim in the United States. You can still buy it. $50. It's this little thing you hold in your hand. There's a little bit of water in it. It has a tube. You breathe in through your nose, and you breathe out through this tube. The air goes down into this little machine you hold in your hand, and it's got water, and you blow bubbles. What that does is puts a resistance on the out-breath, slowing your breathing down. So I would never use bicarbonate for a long period of time without paying attention to the breathing. And the cause of so much acid in body and low oxygen conditions. And so it's part of my whole approach to medicine. You have to be intelligent and you have to really cover the bases, the basic bases. And there's nothing to anybody who's listening to this. There's nothing more important than your next breath. Because if you don't take it, you're dead. Mm-hmm. Gives you a little bit of importance of how the breath is important. So how you breathe, how you take the next breath, almost everything in terms of health. So whatever you're doing when you're trying to treat cancer or heal yourself from any disease, is you need to deal with the most fundamental thing. Bicarbonate gives you instant control. But the breath and slowing down and paying attention to that next breath that's going to keep you alive is a very helpful thing to do. But let's get it back away from carbon dioxide and breathing and sodium bicarbonate and swing back to hydrogen.
Okay.
And then we'll talk about oxygen at the same time. But
okay.
Hydrogen it's like a huge wave coming in, and there are a lot of people actually surfing this wave already. It's in terms of the regular world, it's only being looked at for like 10 years, since 2007. There's been hundreds and hundreds of publications and scientific journals about it in these last 10 years. And it's mostly coming from Japan and China, but there's some research is now being done in the United States. And just so happens that the same hydrogen that can run your car or a train or a bus, the same hydrogen that you can put in a rocket and send a missile up into space, the same hydrogen that runs every sun in the universe. I mean, there's no life without hydrogen. The suns take hydrogen and put it together and make helium, something bigger and fusion, and that runs the universe and all the light in it. That the same hydrogen, which is the smallest thing, molecular hydrogen is even smaller than an electron in terms of electromagnetically, because it's balanced. It has a very small charge. So it's very small. This stuff happens to be the best medicine in the world. And will be the best medicine in the world and the best substance to run the suns and your car and rockets forever. The universe is not going to create something smaller unless you get to the quantum level. Hydrogen is the stuff that if you're dying and you're on your deathbed and you got one more day to live, if you're lucky enough that somebody is paying attention and gets you a hydrogen oxygen inhaler, a machine that just you put on your nose like you put in an oxygen concentrator, and you just breathe it all night long or all day, whatever. If you're dying, you plug it in and you don't take it off until the person's walking around again. And this stuff there's nothing in the medical unit. There's oxygen. They give oxygen. Now, in the future, forever, once people wake up, it'll never be just oxygen anymore. It'll be oxygen and hydrogen. It's hydrogen. Now, I said it's 10 years, but really, they've known about this. This is how stupid doctors are. They know about this for 70 years. 70. In the hyperbaric doctors, doctors who work with Navy divers and the bends when people come up too fast, you know, when they started fooling around going down 2,000 feet, or almost 2,000 feet 70 years ago, they discovered very quickly the only way to survive at the bone-crushing depths, being down 2,000 feet. Man, it's amazing anything human could live down there. And what they do is they pump in the hydrogen. You breathe hydrogen instead of oxygen. And helium, some of it just mostly hydrogen and a little bit of oxygen, or hydrogen, helium, and hydrogen gives a person the ability to survive where you can't survive. And you take that same power from bone-crushing depths, the power to live, and just give it to somebody who's on their deathbed. Or stage 4 cancer or 3 cancer, you know, people still walking around. You know, a couple hours a day breathing this gas is giving you this power over life. And so it's a revolution called the hydrogen revolution. And Of course, I've in my New York publisher has already published my book about bicarbonate, about oxygen, how oxygen is incredibly healing and getting more oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, what I'm coming out with just in the next, right before New Year's or 1 week after,
mm-hmm.
is consumer site showing all the different hydrogen inhalers, the different equipment that's available out there, and especially these ones designed to give hydrogen and oxygen at the same time. So,
That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you for sharing this information. Now, this speaks to this whole thing about people having the ability to control their health, because I know so many people who, as soon as they get sick, they default to, I have to see a doctor, right? Mm. You have to go to see a doctor. And I tell people?
What? I tell people, go to your gas station. You're better off talking to the gas station attendant than your doctor. They know what they're doing. They know where the gas goes, the water, the oil. They're not idiots. But doctors, there's some brilliant doctors, but your regular hypnotized mainstream doctor, he doesn't know the most basic things about health and medicine.
That's true.
People are either open and searching and wanting to know, or they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And they just reject everything. They just don't want to look. They want to listen.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, talking to somebody who doesn't listen is a total waste of time.
Yeah.
It's a total waste of time. So most of us learn that eventually, though most people don't listen. So it's a lonely life because people are really bad listeners. But your specific question, when it comes to somebody's life and their health, this operates very strongly. People either totally, they're just like robots, and or they something has opened their minds, or they're very open because they've always lived a lifestyle of truth and study and doing healthy things. But it's a confusing world because everybody has their opinion. There's the mainstream opinion with the propaganda and billions of dollars behind that. But you said it's a full assault. People are really getting cut down. The whole medical system is adding to it, adding tremendously to it. Not even tremendous. They're probably the biggest, down factor. I mean, just from properly prescribed pharmaceuticals.
Right.
You're talking over 100,000 deaths in America a year for properly described. Forget about medical mistakes.
That's right.
So
I read
that's
that
a lot of people. That's
there's a book I read called Death by Medicine. Opened my eyes.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it was really it stunned me, but it's true. More than 1 million people get killed at the hands of doctors doing what they're supposed to be doing every year already open.
Yeah, I mean, you want to be an evangelist, that type of life. Some people are into that. Come, be born again, and blah, blah, blah. But
yeah, I'm stunned by that. I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about your website, because I would encourage people to go to your website, which is drcircus.com. Because your website is pretty interesting. You have medical articles that you've written on magnesium, bicarbonate soda. You have a whole section about cancer and diabetes. Why don't you speak a little bit about diabetes? Because this is one of the things that will affect a lot of people. And they think it's just something that happens, and once you get it, you can't reverse the effects of diabetes. Diabetes is one of those completely reversible things, isn't it? Am I incorrect on that?
That's a big lie. Big one. Big one. If you listen to your doctor, then it's absolutely true. If you follow Western medical advice on diabetes, it's an incurable disease, and you will never cure it. That is true. But that's only if you listen to your doctor. If you don't listen to him and you listen to other things, sure. And the earlier you catch it, the earlier you catch the problem, the easier it is to treat.
Just like everything else, isn't it?
Just so happens, it's the pancreas that creates a lot of bicarbonate for the body. It's one of its main jobs is creation of bicarbonate. And meaning that an acid condition, one of the first things it starts destroying is the pancreas and the cells that make the insulin and the bicarbonate. So diabetes is the two main, well, there's a few main things. One is this, is acidic conditions, which create low oxygen conditions, low CO2 conditions. One of the first places get hit is the pancreas. The second thing is that almost everybody is suffering from magnesium deficiency. Magnesium is super essential for control of sugar, transport of oxygen, oxygen getting into the cells, poisons getting out of the cells, and on and on and on and on and on. So it's almost impossible to be deficient in oxygen, deficient in magnesium, and not get diabetes or metabolic syndrome. That's why so many people have it. One problem or another. It's a basic, it is focused on the pancreas, but, you know, all the systems start going down. It's a, diabetes is a systemic disease. So it's affecting everything, all the organs, the blood, the sugar.
Can you address this one issue? Because I get a lot of a pushback about this issue about the fish. People are, you know, really mind-boggling dense about eating fish from the Pacific. How can you just for take a minute to explain why the fish in the ocean is something that we, in the Northern Ocean, the Pacific Ocean, why we ought to not be, it's not just the mercury, the radioactivity, it's the whole thing combined. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, and it's not, you know, in terms of mercury, the Atlantic also. It's just, you know, the tuna fish, the bigger fish concentrate, it goes up the food chain. So when you get to the big fish, it's saturated with mercury. And in the Pacific, more with the radiation, of course. And also, the depends on where you are in the Atlantic. You know, in Europe, there's lots of radiation, different places in the water. But, yeah, fish...
Kind of a big thing. And what they tell me is, don't we need the fish? We need fish oils for our body. How can people get what they get out of fish in an alternative, in somewhere else? Because that's one of the big pushbacks, is we need that fish. We have to have fish oil.
Well, do what I do. You grow your own fish. I have a fish farm.
Oh, that's an idea. Just put
aquaponics, meaning fish and vegetables in a closed system.
In other words, don't just grow a garden outside exposed to the air. Put it inside of a greenhouse and maintain it year-round.
Yeah, but you can't escape the air, so forget it.
I really appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us. Thank you so much. And I would encourage anybody who is interested in speaking with you to go to your website and make contact with you and definitely purchase his books and learn about these concepts of self-healing. Thank you, Dr. Serkis, for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Lonnie.
Okay, well, you take care.
Have a good day.
You too. Put your courage feet on, you guys. Bye-bye. So Dr. Serkis had to end the interview about halfway through our show. So in order to fill up the rest of the show, rather than me just get back on the air and talking, I went through my archives and I dug up through an interview that I did with Dr. Chris Busby on 1/4/2017. And I've taken out at least half of it and I have applied it here. It's a good portion of his interview. Where we jump in on this interview is us talking about the difference between Chernobyl and Fukushima, and why that's confusing and why sometimes it feels like we get all confused that Chernobyl and Fukushima are one is exponentially larger than the other. And Dr. Busby begins to explain the changes in this. So thank you to our show once again, Dr. Busby. And it has, as usual, been a pleasure having you on the air with us. Hope you guys enjoy it.
And they were all saying, oh, well, it's not even as bad as Three Mile Island. But anybody who looked at the pictures could see that it was worse.
Right, it blew up, like the plant blew up.
Explosion and everything right. Flew up in the air, you know.
Well, that's what makes me, as a layperson, think it had to have exploded more nuclear radiation because it actually blew up, whereas Chernobyl...
No, you didn't see a picture. I mean, there were no cameras focused on Chernobyl when it blew up. I mean, that was something else. You see the... Chernobyl afterwards. I mean, it's like there's nothing there, you know.
Right.
It's just like a hollow with sort of black smoking bits underneath it. No, it was roughly the same. Okay? Okay, different radionuclides, roughly the same total of quantity of material. Fortunately, a good deal of it went out to sea. Otherwise, it would have been really bad because the point is around Chernobyl, you haven't got such a large population as you have in northern Japan, and what we're interested in here is the exposure to the population. Okay, so Chernobyl was bad because it was in a part of Europe where it could spread over areas that were populated. Fukushima, a lot of it went out to sea, a lot of it fell on the USS Ronald Reagan, which is something that I'm involved in the court case there. But by the time it got onto the land, it had gone out to sea and come back again. There was the wind changed and it went round in a circle and it came back up through Tokyo and then some of it went north to Iwate and all that stuff. Right. So in terms of the total amount, if we say it's the same as Chernobyl, and forget about the stuff that's coming out now, which was very bad, I agree, blah, blah, and all the rest of it, but it's really quite marginally small compared to the amount that came out right at the beginning. Fractional. That amount represents less, or significantly less, than the total amount of radiation that was released into the atmosphere at the time of the weapons testing in the Marianas, you know, the bikini testing, okay?
Yes.
The American testing in the South Pacific. That was massive.
Right.
I mean, that was absolutely massive. They've got like huge, like 44 megatons of explosions, you know,
right.
with all fission products going all over the place, getting up as far as Japan. In fact, they had to... They contaminated that fishing vessel, the Lucky Dragon, and then by the time all those vessels were coming into Tokyo or into southern Japan with their fish cargo, the fishing fleet, they could measure the radioactivity in the fish, even with primitive Geiger counters. Nowadays, we have really sophisticated things that can measure tiny amounts, but the fish were just crackling. So and that hasn't killed everybody, okay? It's caused an awful lot of horrible stuff in the area itself, in the Marianas areas, you know, in the Marshall Islands. And I was in the Human Rights Council in Geneva talking to the people from the Marshall Islands, and I presented a paper there about the effects. But even so, they're still around, you know. The Marshall Islanders are not all dead. They're still...
but they all have diabetes. I mean, this is the thing. You don't die right away from radiological exposure. Yeah. You get various illnesses that impede your quality of life.
Yeah. Of course. I mean, there'll be... And we know, and also that is happening. I mean, if you're talking about the end of life on Earth and all that, I mean, we know that the releases of radioactivity to the environment from the weapons fallout in the 60s
right.
is the cause of the current and increasing... cancer epidemic, okay? I mean, in 1965, the cancer, your chance of getting cancer in your lifetime is about 1 in 10. By 1995, it was about 1 in 7. Then by 2008, it was about 1 in 5. Currently, it's about 1 in 3. And the World Health Organization, not me, say that by 2020, it's going to be 1 in 2. So imagine every person is going to have one person that gets cancer in their lifetime, okay? So, I mean, but nobody says, why is this? But anyway, the answer to why is this is because they've been releasing more and more radioactivity.
Right.
And the biggest release has been the weapons fallout.
The ocean's going to get warmer because it's not functioning the way it's supposed to.
I see. Okay, well, I mean, that's a good point. No, I haven't thought about it. That's possible. I mean, what you're saying is if it kills the microplankton,
yeah.
then they're not going to photosynthesize, and then they're not going to trap CO2. Yeah, no, that's a very interesting point, which I hadn't thought about. Well, that is entirely possible. Yes, of course. That is possible. Yeah.
So that's something that's not even been looked at by anybody.
Not as far as I know. And I mean, well, of course, because they think, you know, I mean, the current argument is that it has no significant effect on these animals. But of course, they're wrong. I mean, there's a chap called Awadhash Ajar. I mean, now I don't know about the microplankton, but I certainly know about invertebrate life. I mean, the worms and the mussels have been studied by this bloke in the University of Plymouth, who's looked at levels of tritium in Plymouth because they have a nuclear submarine base in Plymouth and they release a lot of tritium. And he's measured the amount of tritium and he's looked at the effects on these animals and shown that even at tiny, tiny levels of tritium, it causes a breakdown in their development. So in other words, they not so many of them develop. So you get fewer of these animals. Well, if you get fewer of those animals, they are in the food chain. They're the bottom end of the food chain for everything that goes up from there.
Right.
And so that will have, and the amount of tritium that they produce from these nuclear reactors, you know, like, well, ones near the sea, but all of them really, and also from nuclear reactors on vessels, and also as a result of nuclear testing and all of that stuff, tritium, enormous amounts of tritium are released. Now the argument is that tritium confers a very low dose because it's a very weak beta emitter, but it certainly had an effect on the lower forms of life in the sea. And so I wouldn't have thought it was impossible that it would have effect on CO2 trapping in the way that you suggest. That's possible. But of course, the other thing to say is this, is that if you take the nuclear fuel cycle from cradle to grave, you know, from mining all the way through to disposal, the amount of CO2 generated in that is quite a lot.
Well, yeah, actually, we don't dispose of it. I mean, not when we think about it. There is no disposal. We store the waste. They're not disposing of it. It's not like, oh, they make it go away. They're storing it. And and that actually, the energy involved in maintaining it, I mean, billions of dollars. It has robbed the planet of our ability to.
Yeah, you have to burn a lot of fuel, you know, diesel, to keep it cool. You have, you know, to drive it here to there, to drill big repositories in the ground and stick it down there and all this stuff. I mean, that's not energy that's produced by nuclear. That's energy that's produced by burning diesel. So the International Energy Agency in Paris did a study some time ago, in 2005 thereabouts, I don't know, but anyway, long time ago, which calculated the amount of CO2 that would be saved. And it came to the conclusion that it wouldn't be any, because in fact the amount of CO2 involved in using fossil fuel in order to run the whole fuel cycle, right the way from mining through to disposal, would be, you know, considerable.
Right. Let me ask you this, since you bring up tritium, because, you know, here in the States there's this report that New York City Indian Point nuclear power plant is leaking tritium into the Hudson Bay 65,000% higher than is allowable by the Nuclear Regulatory Agency. Does that present, like you mentioned that it's a low level, does that present any type of a particular health effect on any of those people in New York drinking from that drinking water? Because the Hudson Bay provides drinking water to New York City.
Well, if it's in the drinking water, then it creates a hazard. And anyone living on the coast where there are significant levels of tritium in the water is going to be affected by the vapor coming off the sea. You know,
what does tritium do to the human body? I mean, what does that do to us?
Well, it's just the same as all internal radiation. It damages the DNA, causes mutations, and as a result of that, you get cancer. Your children die. I mean, just as the invertebrate children die, okay, in the studies by Jar, mm-hmm. Actual human children die as they develop, because as you know, I mean, in the womb, when the child starts to develop in the womb, it is an invertebrate almost right at the beginning.
Right.
You know? It goes right through all of these developmental stages that evolution has laid down. I did a study in Diablo Canyon. I was paid some money to look at Diablo Canyon, which releases a lot of tritium, and I to the Pacific. And what I did was I looked at the people who lived in the zip codes that were close to the Pacific, and then compared them with the people who lived in the next zip code away, and then compared those to the whole of California. And I published this. It's out there, you know, in a paper published by a peer review journal, quite recently this year, I think it was.
Do you know what the title is? Do you remember?
No. If you type into Google Busby Diablo Canyon infant, you'll find it. Okay. And what it showed was that there was a statistically significant effect that people who lived in the whole of California over the period that we were looking, I think it was 1999 through to 2012. Anyway, over that period, infant mortality fell because, you know, over that period, you know, technology has provided better medical attention. Yeah. But in fact, if you look at the proximal coastal zip code area, it went down right when Diablo Canyon started. I think we went back to when it started, 1988 or something like that. It went down immediately, and then it went up. So although the whole of California went down like that, the infant mortality rate went up. And we could then plot the infant mortality rate against the tritium releases, because I found the tritium releases. They're documented. If you look at the paper, you'll see there's a graph of the tritium, accumulated tritium dose against the infant mortality rate, and it's a straight line. So there is evidence that tritium causes these developmental effects in human beings as well as in mussels and in ragworm, those things that you go fishing with, you know.
Us to accept cancer? Is that like really the deal? They just expect us to just accept death so that we can have this magical energy, as they call it?
No. Well, they don't. I mean, well, they do, but not to the extent in which it actually happens. That's the point. So they do. So on one level, you're right. They say, well, you know, it's very magical that we've got all this energy and it will save us from this and that and global warming and all this stuff. And as a result of that, we unfortunately have to allow one person in 10,000 to die of cancer. But the problem is they're wrong. It's not one person in 10,000. It's like much more than that, you know. Right. And also they don't mention infant mortality at all. So there are a number of issues that
mutations.
Right. Yeah.
That's pretty serious. That's an impact on their lives.
I know. Well, anyway, the point is it's all getting worse. Okay. This is, you know, the baseline here is that I think, or at least my position is, as a result of 25 years of work, that it's quite clear that we are poisoning the entire planet, and this has been happening since about 1945. And the result of that is that we've got increases in infertility, we've got increases in genetic damage that's resulting in congenital malformations in children, in lots more abortions because they pick up these congenital diseases earlier on by ultrasound and by amniocentesis and so on. So the way it's going, I can see that it's going to be increasingly difficult to have children unless you flush out all the eggs in one go, you know, using whatever these IVF treatments that they have now. And then goodness knows what you're going to get then. You know, these test tube babies. I mean, all right, so they say, oh, well, you know, Gemma was conceived in a test tube and how clever this is and so on. But we don't know what's going to happen to Gemma. We don't know what's going to happen to her. Is she going to die at 40? Is she going to, you know, is her heart going to give out at 37? What's going to happen to her? I mean, people who were born in 1915, 1920, they're still alive. You know, there's a bloke called Nicholas Parsons on the radio here. He's 93 and he's still kicking ass, you know. But we don't know what's going to happen to all these Dolly the Sheep people, you know, that are being produced now.
Well,
I agree. I talked to, long ago, when I first started this in 92, I talked to this guy who was then the director of Greenpeace. And he said, look, Chris, you know, bodies are going to have to float down rivers before anyone does anything. But the truth is that bodies are floating down rivers. It's just nobody looks.
Yeah. They're just like, well, let's look at the other river where there's no bodies floating.
You know, the trouble is this, that you know, we can't blame these people because they've got to survive. I mean, what they do is they have to work. They come home shattered. They have to worry about whether the car could be fixed. and all of this stuff, you know. I'm different because I've always been outside the system. I'm always lived in a cardboard box, you know, because I refuse to. So it's just all the old hippies that are doing this stuff.
The old hippies, actually. Yeah. That's what I've noticed. It's all the old people. I'm 61. There's like nothing but old people involved. I mean, we had a symposium here in town, and it was the same old 30 hippies that go to every single... Yeah. And the young people look at you as if you're just, get over it. Like, there's nothing you can do. Just enjoy your life. Just move on.
I don't think they're even interested in it. I mean, what they're interested in is Facebook and sort of appearing, presenting themselves, you know, in some way on the internet and spending their whole time fiddling with their iPhones. I know
that's... I think they're interested, but I think they're just so angry, Chris, and they feel so disempowered that they really don't know what to do. They throw up their hands and go, okay, you know, like, we can't do anything. And I mean, they're just so outraged that we've been manipulated and lied. The ones that do know about it are very angry people, actually, to be honest.
Well, it's political issue. It's a political issue. Anyway, I have a plan. All right? I do have a plan.
Okay,
I mean, you know, I have a number of plans, but anyway, one plan to address this issue that you're talking about is what we need is an ideology. You know, the problem is that there is no ideology now. We live in a sort of like a market chaos. Everybody has to accept that you know, everything is inevitable because it's driven by the market. You see, and that's if there is an ideology, that's the one that's been sold. Now, there used to be the ideology of the Soviet Union, which is kind of vaguely associated with Marxism, and that in itself was an ideology, but it's out of date. It had to do with a system that no longer exists, where you had workers and you had capitalists and all this kind of stuff. You know, so somebody needs to produce something like Adam Smith, something like Rousseau, something like, you know, what's going on and what can we do about it, right? Somebody's got to do that, and nobody has. Nobody has. So there's nothing that anybody can tie themselves to anymore to say, this is how we want to live our lives, right? So, I didn't want to have to do this because it's a pain in the arse, I have to say. But since nobody else is going to do it, I will.
That's kind of how I feel about
it, yeah. I'm going to go off on my boat at some point when I've got a minute, when I finish this fracking study, which I'm doing now. And that's quite an interesting thing, too.
Wow.
And I'm going to write the new ideology, right? Then I'm going to present it off on the stage with a Fender electric guitar and sing it to the people. You know?
Oh, good. Well, we'll talk to you about that when you come out with your ideology. That would be really great.
Yeah.
So in the fracking, this is another thing about the fracking industry. Do they use nuclear waste or nuclear pollution in the fracking industry?
No, they don't. But I don't think so. I mean, it would be you know, it would be a way of getting rid of the nuclear waste. But I have got no evidence that they do that. But what I think they do is they do uranium shaped charge warheads, because those things, you know how it works. They drill down, then they drill sideways. Okay, then what they've got to do is they make an explosion which cracks up all of the shale, you know, and clears all the space so that the gas will come out. You see. Now, the point is that if you're going to do that, it's much more efficient to do it with a very efficient warhead. And the most efficient warhead they've got is a uranium-shaped charge warhead. So I think probably they... Because after all, what the hell, you know? They can get rid of this waste, which is uranium. They can make a shaped charge of it, and they can make sort of like 300% more fracked volume per unit mass of explosive using that. So I think they probably, that is what is happening, and they do blast these big frack holes, you know.
They do use nuclear components in the fracking,
radioactive components,
because that's their idea of solving the waste problem.
Of course, that's right. But I mean,
insane.
the main thing about fracking is the amount of uranium that they would use if they were using it is like quite small compared to the amount of uranium that's released anyway. Because, you know, like Tom Waits sings, there's a lot going on underground, and if you go underground, there's an awful lot of radioactivity down there. Okay.
Yeah.
And if you take the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania, it's absolutely, you know, chock-a-block with uranium and thorium and radium and all that, and polonium and all that stuff, you know. So what they do, as you know, when you do fracking, is you pump a load of water down there and you explode it all. So the pressure then, you know, cracks everything up, and you create a lot of space and the water contains all these fracking injection solids, bits of sand and whatnot, to allow the gas to come out. And then you pump out all this stuff, which is called produced water. And because it's been down there in contact with all these radionuclides like uranium and radium and whatnot, yeah. It's totally full of uranium and radium and all the rest of it, you see. And these people don't know what to do with it. So what they do is they quietly dispose of it by just pumping it away over the ground, or they put it somewhere, and you know, and it sort of, if you go to Pennsylvania, if you look at the websites of the Pennsylvania state on violations, enormous amount of violations in the fracking territories, because these people just kind of discharge it onto the ground, and then it gets into the watercourses and it affects the water supply that people drink. So then of course all the babies die, see, just like I was saying to you about the tritium. So there's lots of evidence already published that the babies are dying. Well, you see, the problem is that the capitalist system, if we can call it that, just as a shorthand, the system that we have at the moment that makes money, what it does is it needs to have energy in order to do that, right? So in other words, what happens is that it manufactures loads and loads of things that then it, you know, makes people buy with advertising. And a lot of these things, or most of these things, are totally unnecessary. You know, people just need love and comfort and all that. But instead, you know, they get all of these things that you see in the shops when you go along. And there's all these shops and they sell things. Well, to make the shops and sell the things, you need to use huge amounts of energy. So they need to have the energy, which means they have to have the gas. Well, now they can no longer get the gas and the oil from the Middle East. It's very difficult to do that because of all the Arabs and all the problems and all the rest of it, you know. So what they do in America now is they've, and in fact all over the world, is that they've discovered that if they go underground, they can rip even more stuff out of Mother Earth, you know, by
it's
blowing.
It's really up. Just about money then. It's all yes. About money, period. Money, money, money. That's it. That's the thing.
That's why it comes back to ideology, you see, because the ideology has to be shifted from we need to have loads of money and be rich to we need to be happy and love one another.
We need another love revolution. I've always had this theory that the CIA killed the love revolution because we were getting liberated, so they in and killed it, you know.
Of course they did. They killed it with drugs, didn't they?
Yeah. You know. Well, with everything, with money and with drugs. They killed it with drugs and money. I mean, the people that wouldn't take drugs, they took the other drug, which was money, right? So that's kind of the thing. But we do need a love revolution. That's actually one of the things I say in my intro is love is greater than fear, you know, and happiness is resistance. And I'm beginning to say I'm happy to resist. Well, look, we've got 2 minutes left, or a minute and a half left. I want to thank you for joining us on the radio show. To my listeners, just to remind you, we've been listening with Dr. Chris Busby. He's an expert witness and expert scientist in the, I guess, the field of nuclear pollution. Is that correct, Chris?
Yes, well, that's right. Nuclear pollution and health. That's right.
That's right. Well, look, I really appreciate this interview. I hope that sometime in the next few months you'll come back and join us again, because I obviously, as you can tell, I have lots to think about on that. I have lots to say on this one. And I want to keep having it back in people's faces so that we can't go to sleep and turn it off. I want us to remind people that this is, I think it's the most important issue of our time.
This is, by the way, before I go, this is video, right? This is going out as a video, not as
audio.
No,
this will go out as an audio.
Oh,
this
radio.
Is not
okay.
A video. It'll go out as an audio on UCY.TV. So okay. It'll come out. I'll send you the podcast. We actually podcast on our radio station.
Otherwise, I'd have had to put on my makeup, wouldn't I?
That's right. Me too. Exactly right. I had to put on better glasses.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
Well, it's been a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for joining us, and we'll talk with you soon. Everybody, please put your courage feet on, take some action, and remember, love is greater than fear. We'll talk with you soon.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. We'll talk with you soon. I really appreciate it. You take care.
Bye-bye.
God bless you.